I had the same experience when we went, Kishimoto and I. The first place we went to was a new sect in Japan called Tenrico. Well, not very new. It was founded by a woman very much like Mary Baker Eddy. And her doctrine was very similar to Mary Baker Eddy. And the largest wooden building in the world was at this Tenrico Center near between Nara and Osaka. The bedroom of this woman who founded the sect was exactly as she left it when she died, just with everything somewhat disordered, nothing changed. Well, her grandson took us around, and he had been a pupil of Kishimoto's at Tokyo University. And Kishimoto, he said he was called Kish when he was at Harvard, Kish for short, said when this man was at Tokyo, all he was interested in was sports, jiu-jitsu and things of that sort. And he wants to have a conversation with me and have me asking questions. And he said, I don't think he can answer your questions. But to Kishimoto's great surprise, he had developed into quite a philosopher and theologian. And no matter what questions I asked him, he was able to give a very reasonable answer. And as we walked around the grounds, whenever we met anybody, they would kneel in front of him and touch their foreheads to the ground and offer obeisance to him as the head of the order, the grandson of the founder. Well, it happened that I had, in 1930, published a book about Jakob Burma called The Mystic Will. And they had that book in their library. And with great ceremony, they brought it out to me to autograph. So you see, I had some prestige already before I went there. And that was also true at Eheiji, that first monastery where we went on the west coast of Japan, with 9 huge, beautiful buildings. They gave me a book of in pictures, which I have lost somewhere around this room. I had, previous to going to Eheiji, visited a college of the Soto sect in Tokyo, Komazawa, I think it was, and the president of Komazawa, knowing that we were going to Eheiji, had sent a telegram to the abbot saying that you are about to be visited by the abbot of a Quaker monastery. That's what he said. And of course, as Kishimoto said to me just before we got to the monastery, I don't know how we'll be received here. They may not let us in at all. But here they had a welcoming committee and great ceremonies and bowings and everything, like one abbot to another. We were certainly had it well for the next few days. Well, you never know what's going to happen, but there is, I think, a very strong influence of Buddhism in Japan even today. If you ask a college student, what religion are you, he'd say, I'm a Buddhist. And do you believe in Buddhism? Well, I don't know what it is. Or I'm a Buddhist just because my name happens to be registered in a Buddhist temple, or something of that sort. Nevertheless, there is something about Japan, the way people live, the way they talk, their art, their culture in general, that shows very much, I think, the influence of Buddhism. And I think anyone visiting America would find here very much the influence of what's sometimes called the Judeo-Christian tradition. This country was founded by Puritans and Quakers and Anglicans, who are religiously minded people. And that religious tradition has been maintained in this country to a degree which most people don't realize. It's like a fish in the water. The fish doesn't know anything about the water because he's got the water all around him. We hardly recognize the air because we're in it all the time. And we're all the time in this Judeo-Christian tradition. to a degree we don't realize. So those who repudiate Christianity and say they don't believe in God, they don't accept Christ, they don't realize how much their actions and their ethical principles are influenced by Christianity. Even this situation ethics, where you do whatever the situation demands, they have to add something, so long as you do it with love. Well, where'd they get that idea? Well, they got it from Christianity. God is love. You can do anything you want, so long as you do it with love. I think that's situation ethics, isn't it? Some of you have probably read that book. I haven't. It's been issued since I was too blind to read, but I know something about it. The situation, what you do, depends on the situation. That's good existentialism. But you must do it with love. And that's a very important qualification. I have here the shortest, I have quite a lot of books about Zen. I have 3 volumes of Zen, on Zen, written by Suzuki, containing the greatest, the most likely description of Zen, but I have a number of other books, some of which I have given away. I have a book called The Training of a Zen Buddhist Monk, which contains, in a different way, the pictures which, as she showed you on the screen, and others, which I'd be glad to loan if you want. Here's the shortest one I have. It was given to me by the abbot of Myo Shinji. Have I pronounced that right? Huh? Myo Shinji. That's the leading temple of a branch of the Rinzai, I think, sect, not the Soto, I think, of Japan, of Zen. Then every sect in Japan is divided into subsects, so you have an amazing number of sects and subsects of Buddhism, as many at least as you have in Christianity. This tells you what is Zen. And this would give this abbot of this temple visited me while I was in the hospital, and he had all his beautiful robes on, and with him was another abbot of a temple in Kyoto called Roanji, and it's famous for its rock garden. The garden has nothing in it but 5 stones, but these 5 stones are placed in such a way that if you contemplate them and look at them, it will produce peace of mind. It will help make you serene and good-tempered. There's not a thing in the garden but these 5 stones, but it's a very famous garden. 5 stones, and around them is just a level sand. And that's visited by all tourists to Kyoto, as well as the Moss Garden, another famous temple, and 1,000 other, I think there's at least 1,000 temples in Kyoto altogether. One of them has 500 Lohan. They're Buddhist saints, or arhats. 500 of them all together in this one room. Most extraordinary spectacle. Each one of them wearing a crown, and I've been told that one of them is Marco Polo, and another is Alexander the Great, but I don't know how true that is. They all look pretty much alike. But this abbot was a beautiful, he was 90 years old when he visited me in the hospital, and he had with him the abbot of Roanji and his secretary. And the 3 of them very much astonished the hospital attendants, and of course that gave me some prestige in the hospital, which I didn't have before. I have here a statue of the Buddha, which I picked up at a little country store on the roadside. No Buddhist would consider this very valuable, but I like it because it is serene, as a Buddhist should be, as a Buddha should be. You can tell it's a Buddha because of this knot on the head. This knot is not a hairdo, it's an extra brain. The Buddha has 2 brains, one with which he sees things, and the other with which he sees that he sees things, where you hear the hearing and see the seeing. You get a stage back. It's one thing to see things, it's another thing to see the seeing. You can hear things, and it's another thing to hear the hearing. In other words, it's pushed, the knowledge is pushed back a stage with this other brain. So when you're enlightened, you have the equivalent of another brain, because you see the seeing, you hear the hearing. You're not I-conscious anymore, but you're conscious of the I-conscious. You're conscious of consciousness. The I-consciousness is out there where you can get hold of it and suppress it and remove it. So you're no longer bothered with this ego that's always wanting things. See, the essence of Buddhism is that life is craving, is desire, tanha, and Buddhism is an effort to remove craving, remove desire, to have a life without desire, and as a result you will be completely at peace. So Buddhism is a purely therapeutic. It's not a philosophy, it's not a theology, it's not a metaphysics, it's a psychology. And Buddhist psychology is very much, very complicated and very profound. I have a book in there that lists 84 different types of consciousness in one Buddhist system of psychology. Now that's pretty fine division. The Buddhists were more thorough psychologists than any psychologist that's ever appeared in the West. They knew all about the subconscious. They called it the reservoir consciousness.